All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio for our special May Day program. So we're very happy to be joined today by Lali, who is a retired nurse, but she is also a former presenter of Green Left Radio and actually one of the original founders of the program. So yeah, we'd love to give you a warm welcome back to Green Left Radio,
yeah,
Lali.
Good to have you back, Lali.
Thanks.
But also, Lali was also heavily involved in the historic 1986 50-day Victorian Nurses and Midwives strike, which is actually probably one of the more significant protests and strikes organised by nurses in Australian history. Because actually often nurses, like teachers, often there's a lot of political pressure and to them to not go on strike because of the kind of essential care work that they often provide. So I think it was obviously a very significant kind of strike in a lot of ways. And, you know, a lot of trade unions look to it in terms of lessons and inspiration. So Lali, what can you tell us about this historic nurses' strike, which went on for more than 50 days?
Well, it was amazing. It so makes me emotional to talk about it. It was inspiring, and the determination, the commitment, and also the rage that displayed by the nurses was incredibly admirable. It's been it's actually one of the longest and largest strikes by women in the world. And people don't understand that. I think another strike was held in Michigan in the early 1900s by a few hundred people, a few hundred nurses. They went for 3 years, or it was hit and miss. But the nurses' strike was significant in many ways. I think the key thing is that it challenged the accord which was set up by the federal government, Bob Hawke and Keating government, in 1983. It started in 82, and it was a total betrayal of workers of Australia. And many people don't understand the political background of the strike and what the nurses were up against. An incredible force of politics by the federal government, the state government, and the employers, because the ALP had signed this accord with the ACTU. It was an exchange for what they called social wage. So essentially what they did was they transferred workers' wages towards setting up programs like Medicare and superannuation, apparently improved health, higher education, and so on. But these are the key factors of the strike.
Yeah, and what key? Oh, Zane, you had a question.
Well, and just to clarify, under the accord, you'd get this improved social wage, but the trade-off is workers were not meant to go on strike anymore, because this came off the back of the 70s, where there's lots of strike action. Yeah,
that's right. There was 90-20% strikes that went on at that time before the accord was signed, and it was a plot, I guess, put together by Bob Hawke, Keating, and unfortunately Laurie Carmichael, who was a member of the Communist Party, who supported the whole thing. And in their mind, I guess, there were two things. One was they wanted to economically manage a period where there was high inflation, high unemployment, and Fraser government was going down the tubes, basically. And they wanted to bring the unions supposedly into the policymaking process, which was a con in many ways. But in the long term, the union membership fell from 51%, and today it's sitting at 12.5%. And it's very weak, unable to achieve a lot for workers. And the wages dropped from like 63% to 56% since that time. and 50% drop in industrial disputes after the strike. That's the sort of impact the accord has had. And it happily restored profit share and job growth in the private sector. And the profit just soared at that time. That was the bigger plot in the background, I guess. You know, it was surreptitious in many ways.
And Lali, what can you tell us about some of your experiences as a kind of participant in the strike? Because something that went on for more than 50 days, there obviously would have been a great sense of comradeship and camaraderie that would have been developed in that strike.
Oh yeah, it was fantastic. I wouldn't exchange it for anything in my life, because it was inspiring. All the nurses were geared up for the fight, and individually speaking, we set up a strike fund which attracted hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we started to give nurses money for their, you know, everyday expenses, paying bills, mortgages, and all sorts of things. And I moved a motion in the council to make sure that none of the union staff were going to get wages. They were going to get all their bills paid by the strike fund as well. So it was very significant. And the sad thing was, many nurses are married to policemen who attacked picket lines, and many marriages broke up. It was socially a huge challenge for individual nurses, but they held on. I mean, 20,000 nurses is no joke. Nurses from places like Patchwalok, Stawell, Ararat, which was sort of minute towns out in the countryside, they were all at picket lines. First time in their life. It was inspiring, really, really inspiring. And, you know, you've never seen that anywhere in the world since before that or since then. The individual nurses were very determined, really determined to get what they wanted, because it was insulting. Because one of the key things to understand is that for 30 years, the nurses had not had a wage rise. There was a no-strike clause in the award because it was considered a vocation, and it was apparently essential services. And the strike was we were able to remove that clause from the nurses' award. And the award, the new award offered by the Kane government at the time, was a demotion for most nurses and a wage loss for majority of them. So the individual nurses were absolutely furious. They're beyond furious, actually. That's why it lasted so long. And you know, lots of individual nurses suffered at that time because of wage losses. Some took waitressing jobs and different jobs to make ends meet as well. So it brings tears to my eyes just to think about.
Lali, one of the interesting things that I only recently learned about the strike was the way that it was sequenced and the way that it built and rolled out over time. And one of the challenges, I think, for the Palestinian solidarity movement is there's been this marathon, week after week rallies, but how do you make the story new? How do you pitch the story so that every day in the media and in the newspapers, oh, this thing has evolved, it's new, it's taking on new life, and then there's a new wave of reporting. I think the way that the nurses' strike rolled out was very clever in this regard.
Yeah, it was almost a given in many ways, because there was the media were the ones who challenged us. They challenged us in the form of anti-worker attitudes, sexism, racism. I was classified as a Sri Lankan terrorist at that time. And, you know, we were countering all those allegations. And also they were like vultures. They were hunting for someone to die so they could blame us for it. So the dynamic was high-pitched. You know, the 80% of the people supported the strike, and the picket lines were always very active. And the trade union movement while being captive to the Accord, were itching to help us. And there were lots of unions who helped us during the process, providing us food at picket lines and support as well, other support as well. And Irene Bolger was a challenge to the sexism at that point of time that heightened the intensity of the strike. And every day the press will try, if you look up the press at that time, they were looking for people, patients who would die or who were very ill, who were ignored by the nurses and so on. But we, what we did was we kept the emergencies functioning. We kept the intensive care units functioning. We didn't touch the cancer hospital. We didn't touch the children's hospital and so on. So we strategized in such a way that the essential part of the population were cared for. And that introduced a dynamic that, you know, we had the sympathy of the public because they knew we were doing the right thing by looking after the extremely ill, and we were being challenged. And it, I think that the dynamic rolled by itself in many ways. On a daily basis, you know, the people would toot when they drive by in support of the picket liners, and it was just like a festival for 50 days.
And was it right that, like, one workers at one hospital would go out on strike, and then the next day or a couple of days later, another hospital would go out on strike, and then
yes,
another?
That's right. The larger hospitals in the city went out first, one after the other. And eventually we pulled out different areas at different times. But the intensive care was the final point, the crisis point in December. So it was a build-up, as you were saying, the rolling out the strike. We started from the least affected patients to the most affected. And it was seen with sympathy and empathy by lots of people who've been to hospitals. They were ex-patients. So many of people go to hospitals. So it was a combination of that emotion from the public and the fact that we were very careful how we rolled the strike out in terms of not harming anyone. There wasn't a single death because of the strike.
So what can you tell us a bit about some of the political background to the strike, especially the kind of negotiations you had with the government of the day? Was it a Liberal government or a Labor government in power at the time?
Labor government. Bob Hawke had come in 83 with Paul Keating, and there was John Kane, the Victorian Premier, and we had White, I forget his first name, the Health Minister for Victoria. And it was rife with the sexism. We were called all sorts of names under the sun. We were called thugs, we were called fascists, we were called communists, which I thought was a great thing, but that's beside the point. The politics was a mixture of sexism, racism, and basic anti-worker attitude. And I think the thing that was holding all these people back was the fact that they were tied to the Accord. The employers' desire to keep this going, and this was not public knowledge that, you know, it was that Accord that drove the attitude of these people, and they used every possible insult they could think of at the nurses, and particularly at Irene, because they called her all sorts of, they called her the Bolshevik and so on, which she thought was great, the void, the badge. and others was, they did all sorts of horrible things to us. Like they attacked the nurses at Royal Melbourne Hospital on horseback. They sent the police in, and I was at the picket strike. I remember that. And it was a horrendous attack against the women. We were called everything under the sun. The women should go back and do their work. This is a vocation. Why are they striking? You know, they've had enough. They're not breadwinners of the family. You know, whatever you think of was happening at that particular time.
All right. So maybe to kind of finish up the interview, any kind of final comments and what kind of lessons do you think the strike offers for unionists today?
Don't trust the ALP. I think unions have to be free to do what they have to do for members and not tie themselves to political parties that, you know, wane and switch and do all sorts of betrayal acts in the process of this while keeping the unions captive within their realms. Unions have to truly represent the workers and give them courage. And the workforce has changed enormously in the last 40 years. Like this year is the 40th year since the strike took place. And if you look at the media, I looked it up several times, actually, and you wouldn't find Irene Bolger in any of the significant union leaders in the media. And if you look at the significant strikes, you won't find the nurses' strike as a significant strike across the world or across the nation. It's a blackout, by the media. And people have to understand these things a bit better and understand what is the role of the union. And if the union doesn't do its job, members decline. And that's what the accord did. Once the union became captive to the ACTU and the ALP, membership dropped enormously. It used to be around 57% or something, almost 60%. Today it's 12.5%. So that's a result of unions not doing their job and the result of members not being able to participate in the decision-making processes of the union. I think it's a lesson that every person needs to take on board, because if you don't fight for your rights, you lose. And the BLF had a really good slogan, if you don't fight, you lose. And I really believe in that. Workers today are seeing the enormous decline. I mean, the contract work, it has become from, the permanent jobs have completely gone. Everything's on contract now, one-year contract. How do you take out a mortgage on a one-year contract job? You can't. So the living conditions should awaken people to these sort of terrible conditions under which they're working today. The anxiety and the mental health that affects people who don't have a permanent job or at least a five-year contract, even if they went that far. But it's reflecting itself in the way people are living today. Now they're struggling for food. They're struggling with all this war that's going on. It's getting worse. So unions should be doing something, but at the Palestinian question, for example, why is it that the unions aren't coming out in force to fight against a government today that is supporting the war against Iran? It's all connected, and politically, money, taxpayers' money is going to fund the war instead of building houses or funding education. So if workers and unions don't participate in these struggles, workers lose, people lose.
Well, thank you very much, Lali. That's a good way, a good note to end on. And thank you very much for being on our program. And yes, and it's great. It was great having you back on Green Left Radio.
Yeah, cheers.
Lovely to be back. Thanks, guys.
All right, rock on.
Have a good day. Happy May Day.
Happy May Day. Yeah.